I study social complexity in primate groups, and there's a way of thinking of successive levels of social complexity, and I like to think about individuals that are engaged in interactions, and interactions over time constitute relationships, and because relationships don't happen in a vacuum, they start to define some kind of group structure. And the person who kind of really articulated it in primatology was Robert Hind, who now writes specifically about psychology of war, and he tries to follow the same kind of thing. So he takes, let's say, the idea of violence and what violence is on the individual level. So what's the neurobiology of it? What's the psychology of it? Then violence between individuals in an interaction. But then when you start getting into relationships, there's this kind of interesting, right? Because to be violent as a group towards another group, you have to have some non-violent, right? Strong social connection as a thing. So he says, if you look at the continuum from an individual to a nation going to war, what makes it acceptable to individuals to participate in an international warfare? And he kind of says that's part of the urgency, is to identify how it became acceptable for someone to go to work in Nevada or in Las Vegas, and all day he's pressing buttons that are, you know, sending missiles in Pakistan. How could that be acceptable? Good family man, you would say. So I think that's an interesting way to start to see. So what's peace in individuals? What's in it? And I'd like to enter it because there's a sense in which sometimes we want one definition to fit all those layers, and it just doesn't.
Yeah, I guess that's one problem, is what do we do with newer ideas of the history and the anthropology and the behavioral science that would undergird these problems in very different ways now than they would have then?
I feel like it would be more helpful to think about these questions in terms of how jurisdiction is changing, right? Like with technologies and, you know, also with, just the question of quote-unquote terrorism, right? The fact that certain societies of men are not considered states, but are considered terrorist groups. So, you know.
In a way, I read his What Peace Is. It's very biblical. It's almost like, why do you have a taboo against something? It's because it's there, right? So you say, no man shall kill another man. So it's almost like by saying what peace is, he's kind of telling you at the same time what exists and what we know exists, right? So he's telling you states shall not make peace if they have an intention to have war in secret. But clearly that's the case. And what happens with terrorist groups is that they haven't agreed yet to live in that duality. They're still all aggression.
You know, I think that the fact that the European Union, for example, is supporting this project is interesting to me, because I think that there is also I think it is linked to identity politics, this project. I think it's linked to the identity politics of the state. I think the state is trying to figure out what is its position, what is its relevancy, how is it going to maintain itself, and its jurisdiction, and maintain this conviction that it is, you know, the reason why we don't fall into, this state of nature in which we will all kill each other. Like, without the state, basically, you know, the argument is that that's what we would fall back into. There's, like, something that was already here, and it wasn't constructed, which is this natural state, which is us just killing each other. And that the state is keeping us from doing that. So it seems to me like this is, using this text is making this project an identity politics project, which is one about the identity of the state. What is that? And the state itself trying to reassert its relevancy for people, so they feel that, you know, that it indeed, you know, this state indeed can kind of evolve with us.
Well, clearly, I think that there is a question about the selection of the text itself. I mean, and opens up possibilities about what to do with it. I mean, because as a point of departure, we can accept that it's a very dramatic, you know, gesture, let's say, that is anticipatory, is logically the drama comes when you locate it and somewhere in the 18th century, and you know, I don't know how many things, you know. But at the same time, opens the question that you open is how do you complicate the text in terms of really opening up new spaces of operation, which is ultimately, I think, a question that you've asked about how to come up with different language to describe what has already mutated into other formations, other configurations. I mean, just the image of Sudan, this, you know, fragmenting, challenging a whole reconstitution of a territory based on colonial borders, and now finally another more micropolitical condition beginning to, you know, to open up other kind of imaginary of a region based on whether community scales or tribal or I don't know, but this challenging of the jurisdictional as very much established and categorized by those traditions is embedded in the text and needs to be challenged. So I'm wondering, for a moment when you were talking, I was thinking, how can we contaminate, you know, the Kantian set of notions, hospitality being one of the most powerful ones, but also almost at times the kind of feeling that is almost like Bush talking about, you know, borrowing labor to then return it or something. But, you know, many, there is a conversation about the text as a point of departure, the possibility of the text being implicated with other things, which could be an interesting project. I'm thinking already of other projects that can begin to branch out, but also particularly I hope the discussion was about the nature of the concepts themselves, hospitality, peace, and how slippery they can be. I mean, a question from Steve last night for me was fundamental. Later I was trying to, because, you know, in a way he would sometimes just throws a bomb, but in this case is that there is a very slippery, how would I call it, dark side to the whole thing, which we, at least what I understood from him, I thought was one of my questions today to follow that, is that behind the kind of jihadist, is that for the project, or the Bible, or the, or this utopian or Hitler projects that pursue in fact peace through fundamental violence. I mean, in terms of like the other side, what space that has in the text? I mean,
well, it's the vision of perpetuity, perpetual perpetuity, and finality. Those are the, I mean, I think those are the things that pick up on the utopian, the dangers of utopia.
Well, I'm thinking, I mean, about the text, which I barely read, but also I'm thinking about the project and the relationship of the text and the project, which is an interesting, I don't know if diverting here for a moment, but I think it's all related, because there is a critique about the kind of the text as a foundation for this, but also something that has been problematic. I know that you've thought about this and you've gotten a level of criticism about this in terms of the involvement of the expert, let's say, that is, or the site where the expert is able to, you know, to display a sort of a point of view about the text. I'm thinking of this because already there are certain topics like hospitality which suggest the site of discourse or exchange or dialogue. What comes to mind is the image that you mentioned about this doctor, this woman, who an activist, who you are engaging, who would dock a boat and then would take women to have abortions outside the jurisdictional zone of international waters, for example. Where does the dialogue take place? Where does the convening occurs? And the questions that emerge there in terms of power and sort of the stakeholders at play or the constituencies. Because, for example, there is something about the presence of power, not only the United Nations, and as you were saying, the legitimation, again, of these institutions that have perpetuated themselves somehow in the discourse, and then the expert, or as it's an emblematic force of power in terms of so what is the relationship of that to, you know, to thinking of other modalities. I'm thinking already of projects in terms of where the discourse takes place and who is involved, you know, and whether each of these terms can be themselves operational to take them as curatorial sort of devices to rethink where the project is distributed, and I don't know, maybe complicated, but it's an interesting question.
Who's that project? It's in Grant's book, Conversation Pieces, in Grant Kester's book. There's someone who did a project that's also on a boat where he brought, like, do you remember this
politicians?
Politicians and, like, prostitutes.
But he had to take
them.
He's already taken care of that.
That's what I was talking about. See,
it's yeah, it's like a they're negotiating over the right to use certain areas in the city,
right.
And how those rights will be policed,
mm-hmm.
and there's this kind of ongoing, there's this cyclical problem, and the artist, whose name I can't remember because I don't remember enough about the project, takes the groups out of the public, because the one of the problems is in public, a certain kind of dialogue, only a certain kind of dialogue can take place, and I think you talked about this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what kind of dialogue takes place in public and what kind of dialogue can take place in some other sort of space. And he, I think, successfully resolved certain elements of the of the problem by putting people on boats and taking them out onto the lake. And it's not specifically about getting out of the legal jurisdiction, but getting out of a kind of almost like a phenomenological jurisdiction. Like, what happens when you no longer feel yourself
mm-hmm.
in that
mm-hmm.
the space of that tension, and you go into some... I mean, it's another vision of nature in some way, right? Like, you go out into the waters,
mm-hmm.
and it's not really constant nature, although constant, there's like seven versions of nature in this one text. This is another, I think, interesting place to enter it. But, like, where do we go, and why do we go there? And, but the text does, you know, it does ask people, it asks for people who can challenge it. And I think that that sets a bar in terms of who speaks with this and in terms of this text. Although you could also just say, I didn't really read much of it, and just talk about what's interesting about the possibility of peace, which I imagine happens a lot. But you've talked about... going to other places and the problems of translation and cultural locality. And you come as a guest to those places and have to engage with the problem of hospitality just to introduce this conversation. What does that do? How does the text function in those terms? And I don't know what the other half of that is, but like, I feel like the project itself has to engage with the problems of hospitality.
What would peace mean to you? If it has nothing to do with Kant, if it rejects Kant, if it engages that, like, where do you in your own life negotiate it, find it, or is that just not the framework that you would use?
Well, I guess my relationship to peace would be in its relationship to the absurd, I guess, is what interests me. And it, as a continuous process, a kind of never-ending dialogue. But I would say what interests me the most about peace is this relationship of it to the absurd. And I guess that's where I find it interesting as where I think it fits into the aesthetic sphere versus the political or the bureaucratic or the ethical. I think it has this relationship to the intrinsically to the aesthetic sphere. That's what makes it so, it itself so evasive. That's what interests me, and I guess that's the way that I reason about it.
The most powerful statement I heard from the interviews, from not experts but the others, was when people in the middle of Pakistan saying that peace for them was to the possibility of walking freely through their city. So on one hand is that, which suggests the kind of, in the end of the spectrum here, away from the state, the formation of autonomous zones that have become so relevant, in a sense, from the left and the right, let's not forget, versus, which has produced a kind of antagonism against the state, against government, against welfare, the welfare state. And on the other, the aspiration, and I would maybe should say it myself, of the need, in fact, for government to regulate certain conditions that have to do with rights that really protect aspects of the collective that are being really usurped and undermined. You know what I'm trying to say? There is a tension at this very moment. That's the reason I'm saying, yes, who cares about Kant, but the point of departure is that the very nature of our debate at this moment continues to be the polarization between individual and collective rights. You see what I'm trying to say? I mean, and so to what degree then we dare to back to the absurd as an individual aspiration? How does that percolate into the collective? and therefore other registers such as economic issues. I mean, if I was to ask some of my relatives in Guatemala what is peace for them, is to really have, you know, a level of economy to, you know, and access and rights, which is now beginning to sound like the neoliberalist agenda. So this convoluted, you know what, so I'm wondering the point that one, but this individual collective, so I found it very interesting how quickly it is solidified, you know, when somebody that is in the middle of a territory of conflict aspires to a notion, which isn't that far from here. I remember Lucia and Giacomo, you know, when they were living in Tijuana, coming here in the middle of the violence in those days, coming to Balboa Park just to walk their dog. It was like, oh my God, this is like, you know, sounds kind of weird, but they were saying, now, you know, this is just breathing. You know, it's like the way they were moving in Tijuana, like completely feeling that any moment the bullet were going to, like, so I don't know if I'm getting lost with the statement. The point is, there is something about this dislocation of the topic according to individual experiential registers, but also how we catapult that to formations, governmentally speaking, of conditions of rights, you know, to allow to the discussion to come back. Because you see it from the right, from the Tea Party, who wants to get rid of government, to the possibility of government at this moment to really to engage another type of discussion about social justice, which is really has happened in other countries, really. I mean, and the necessity for the state. Mm-hmm. And that there's another scale, sorry, which has to do with the transnational, or you know. I'm disillusioned with the United Nations, and but that's not to say that there is not the need for rethinking, so how do we regulate and calibrate those relationships. So there is individual, the collective, and then that might be passé for many people. I was in a meeting in Oxford, in this villa, really strange meeting, a meeting curated by this ex-diplomat of the ambassador to the UN of England. And I wasn't at dinner, and I just made the mistake maybe of making a naive comment about what's going on with the UN, about this, the need for this international, and everybody looked at me like, you don't talk about that. There's no, it's a institution that is like fought, and that, you know, there is almost like this belief that there is a potential for that. So again, now the other aspect of this is what maybe Mike was talking about yesterday. The idealization on one end, and on the other, the futility that is embedded, the kind of, you know, the fatalism behind this, because just like democracy, somehow peace might not be ultimately achieved. It's an ongoing, unfolding process, right, of dissent and consensus and back to dissent. And so it's a difficult thing to handle.
But we're witnessing a dialectic between individual coming into the state back in several places. For me, the Middle East, of course, is in the middle, but Muqtada al-Sadr, who was head of insurgency, goes away to Iran for a few years. He comes back, and in his speech, he clearly makes the decision to now be a politician. And he tells his people, do not go out to the street. The few of us who have to fight will fight, and we will solve it in a politician way. So he himself is making the transition and coming back and almost starting to operate on a state level, you might say. And again, going back to Lebanon, it's the UN inquiry into Rafiq Hariri's assassination that is allowing Lebanon to now go through a dialogue. Hezbollah left the government. Saudi Arabia and Qatar tried to come to start to mediate. As soon as Hezbollah said we would have to reject what the UN has said, they left. So you're starting to have this dialogue with certain individuals, but they're not fighting on the street. And if you think about peace as wanting to be able to walk on the street, then you start to see places where this interaction between individuals who have been fighters come back, now are able to say something to their people. I think it's an amazing.
I just kind of wanted to quickly go, what you were saying about how it's important to place ourselves within the culture that we are in discussing this. And I think it's important to note that our idea of collective, the idea that we live in a democracy, our entire identity is ultimately affirmed because of the exception that we create, which is basically the idea of terrorism, that the people who are outside of our democracy, right? And so, to me, I feel like that's kind of an important question, because you cannot define any kind of idea of a global peace without understanding how the nation state continues its own identity by suppressing the people who are outside of its rules, right? And so, which kind of goes back to the idea of Kant and whether Kant it's a good starting point, but the entire point of it is also that our entire definition of human nature is kind of derived from this lineage of thought, which ultimately is where we are now, in which we're defining, we have these rights, right, and then we define a kind of evil around which we have these laws, and we're a state that we're obsessed with evil, right? We're obsessed with crime, and it's a kind of fetish, and I feel like that's also kind of an important thing to start talking about. Because
I think that's interesting. As I was going through the text, I found it interesting that so much of the basis for the foundation of the state or for the rationality of the state is derived of fear, of the individual fearing attack from the other, from a stranger, and that fear, that kind of xenophobia almost, making it so desirable to engage with that person at the level of the creation of law. And that's why I thought that that the section in hospitality was interesting, because you have there a very strong sense of this confrontation with a stranger, and what do you do when the stranger is at your door, and you kind of you start to develop, I guess, in that confrontation and that exchange. I think it's interesting to start to think about different ways of articulating the formation of collective outside of let's prevent us from harming each other, or let's let our fear of each other dictate how we're going to form and dictate law to therefore mold the state. So I thought that was a very important site, or I found it a very important site of possible intervention into this notion of confrontation with other cultures, with other individuals on a very personal level. This imagining, I guess, interpersonal relationships as much more than something to overcome fear of the other. And I think that's very pertinent to the region where we are in San Diego, and notions of immigration and all of that. So this notion of citizenship, of a citizenship, I guess, that can be created that's outside of fears is interesting to me.
Right, it's true that Kant is kind of completely fixated on the fear of the stranger becoming kind of one who holds you hostage, or he's completely transfixed by this fear of this guest who will not just become a guest in the home or whatever, not just be somebody that you extend hospitality to, but will finally become a master of your home and kind of usurp your place. It's kind of a very old and problematic logic of defining one's own kind of sense of safety in opposition to someone else who will take it from you.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there a little passage there where he says, if people come from other lands and start to have normal relations, that's an opportunity for two states to actually, right, not be at war with each other because there's already that kind of engagement.
It's more modest and more kind of...
I was thinking about peace. You know, if we can think of peace as the absence of war, a lot of times that's the way it's defined. I was thinking about the conversation that is happening now with health. So for a long time, health was defined as the absence of disease. And that's changing now. So now health is considered health equals well-being, community. So it's almost like a generative. You start identifying an absence of something, and you kind of give it a name, but it's always in opposition to what it's absent, right? But then you have an opportunity, because you've given it a label. You say peace. You're not just saying no war. That you can expand, right? Have more definitions, have this kind of plurality, and not always be in opposition. So Latour gave this compositionist manifesto in LA, he was, and that's what he was kind of saying, the same thing that you said in part of your introduction about how do we get away from just being oppositional, how do we multiply, pluralize it. And I think it's been interesting to see health get grow like that, and I'm wondering how can peace, you know, how can we do the same with peace.
I know from my work with Teddy, I know what role the border plays and what role Tijuana holds in his life and in his practice and his thinking. As an outsider, as one who's passing through, what role, how are these issues affecting your lives and your practice and your thinking, and how are you negotiating all of this? I guess I'm trying to just like... move the
bring it local
in a different direction. If only for Ashley and I, we're passing through. I mean, from my, it's extraordinary. These planes every day. It's like,
the helicopters.
I mean, from my friendship and my work with Teddy, I assume that to live in San Diego is to kind of also be fundamentally tied to Tijuana. But at the same time, I'm not always sure when I pass through here if that is indeed the case for others that live here. Maybe not yourselves, but others in the hotel or wherever that I'm staying. And is there a way that you could help me understand or think through some of
I would say that these issues. It's much more that if you live in Tijuana, you're tied to San Diego. And you live,
Misael, can you repeat that again? Sorry,
I think it's more true that if you live in Tijuana, you're tied to San Diego, than if you live in
That's
San Diego,
right.
You're tied to Tijuana. At least how people move back and forth across the border. But in terms of, I mean, some of these issues, and like Tijuana as a site, I was interested because, I mean, in the text, it talks so much about law and law being the basis for the control of chaos and the basis of the state. And I was like, well, what do you do in a scenario where there is no rule of law, essentially? Or where law is, I don't know, something that's not being actually enforced and it's not actually serving to control chaos. And you have kind of conflict and war and the absence of peace, not necessarily because of the fighting of two states, but the fighting of a state with, I don't know what you would call that in Kantian terms, it's a group of I don't know, savages. So I thought that's why I was interested in this notion of reopening the basis for the formation of I guess social arrangement. Not necessarily in relation to the state, but in relation to interpersonal relationships and the connection of that you have with others, as opposed to the connection that you have to a state when the state is essentially absent or is seen as too corrupt to actually function to your benefit. But that's how I think I would approach this text and these issues in the context of Tijuana. Would be trying to intervene at that site of the formation of different types of social relationships to try to engage or to try to, I guess, rearticulate a public sphere that has been largely co-opted by violence. So that's just my own in my own work. That's kind of what I would be interested in doing in relation to Tijuana.
Yeah, because, right, so there's so much violence, and you still can't call it war, right? In the kind of way that we're thinking about war here, the way Khan was thinking.
Although it has been called the drug war.
Yeah.
Like the war on terror.
Yeah, but I would rather go to Tijuana than to go to Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to mention one thing. A colleague of mine teaches at a city college here, in political science. And at the beginning of every semester, she asks the students to take out a piece of paper, to put where their home is, and to start drawing around it. They can do anything. They can draw to. She says 99% of them don't include Tijuana or the border in that picture. And they write right here. They'll put France, they'll put anything, but they... Tijuana is not in there. It's like non-existent. And these are, you know, college students coming in city college, so they grew up here.
Is that a blind spot? More than that?
Yeah, even more. You have to be actively turning away, right, for not to see that.
How do you negotiate that, or how do you maneuver in response to that in your work and your practice?
In response to what?
The perception that there's a blindness or an inability to take either responsibility or to acknowledge one's interdependency.
We follow Teddy around.
In Tijuana.
We follow you around.
But I mean, this goes back to Teddy's question for thinking about the relation between the personal and the collective. Right? But what happens when you're embedded in a kind of a collectivity that's fundamentally...
You know, when I was for a moment, I was imagining, and I know Eyal Wasman has been lately talking about this elastic or the political elastic or something like that. But in the images that were triggered by some of your comments, suggest that these concepts, of course, are so situational, you know, they are like constantly moving, and sometimes they really ground themselves in the micropolitical dimension of a community, enabling, you know, the kind of construction of other paradigms and protocols to the kind of all of a sudden, stretching all the way to the moment when Sergio Fajardo in Medellin, being a philosopher, decides to run for mayor. And shifts completely the direction of the engagement of violence through, in fact, the formation of a new pedagogical model at the scale of the collective, building library parks in the middle of shanty towns, completely turned the table around. The state now, all of a sudden, pursuing a very different politics, enables other protocols. And then it goes back to the macropolitical, the autonomous, the individual, in fact, pursuing at the scale of a block in Tijuana, a kind of project of healing and, you know, exchange. So I'm just wondering how these things move, because we've grown, and I hear it in your statement sometimes, a kind of a certain level of antagonism to certain concepts, which is fine. I'm also in the same boat, that tend to also continue to kind of perpetuate this polarization of these concepts instead of really producing, well, not only new practices but new protocols that would allow other levels of So this is my question in my own practice. How do we, you know, because in certain groups, if you were to talk about the need for government and the need to, you know, you're condemned as, or if you, you know, and so how do you, which is a question that I think that is most compelling, is the formation of a new, well, I don't have to say language or more operative concepts that allow us to be a lot more flexible in the use of these, you know. The whole thing is so polarized. The whole dialogue is so polarized.
Mm-hmm. I read the essay and I kept going back to the first sentence in the essay, maybe because I'm at that, you know, simple level. And I think the first sentence describes maybe a position. You know, it's
It describes many things. First of all, it's like the perpetual peace. These words were once put by a Dutch innkeeper on his signboard as a satirical inscription over the representation of a churchyard. So first of all, we have an innkeeper. Second of all, we have a kind of a collage, right? Like we have perpetual peace written under or over the representation of a church. So it also, for me, because I personally just operate at the level of visuals and not at the level of text, that you have, it introduces also the notion of hospitality and the notion of the inn as a space, right? And the position of the innkeeper as that person that mediates maybe the position of other people who are in the inn. And right, throughout the text he proposes, you know, like the characters in the text, you have the statesman, the philosopher, the assassin, the poisoner. And I've been thinking a lot about the idea of the traitor or the double agent, and the way in which I think understand that we are double agents and that we are traitors essentially. And that position allows you to operate at either ends,
right?
And to constantly kind of turn things around. And it's interesting that you brought this the example of Lebanon. But the thing in Lebanon is that everyone is a traitor.
Yeah.
And everyone is a double agent.
Stranger.
And everyone, and in that sense, I think it's quite an extraordinary situation, because the absence of peace is also the absence of war. It's also the presence of peace is also the presence of war. And the reason why the situation becomes very interesting is because you can say at any moment war can happen, at any moment peace can happen, therefore neither will happen. Even when actually bombs are hauled on you, in Lebanon specifically, there is a pocket of peace within it. And in a situation where there's no, acts of violence, there's always the presence of war. And so, and in that sense, I just get like, yes, the essay has many very interesting situations, but I always kept back just like, he's Dutch, he's an innkeeper, he's essentially an artist, a modern artist, who does takes an image and writes a text in response to it. And neither each on their own don't make any sense, but when you bring the picture of the church and put next to it perpetual peace, something greater than these two moments is created. And it's a moment that I think is and it's also because he's not really held accountable. That innkeeper cannot be held accountable because it's at the end, it's a joke, it's ironic. And as a position, I think the position of the artist as sometimes one which is not held accountable or can perform actions which maybe sometimes don't, are conceived of as not carrying any weight, then maybe puts you in a situation where one could take advantage of that. The reason why I stepped up how long ago is because I've been obsessed with this book, which I keep on referencing, which is Brecht's War Primer. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it.
What's the name of the author?
Bertolt Brecht.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right. War Primer. And it's essentially, I don't know, when I read that first sentence, it was essentially that when Brecht was in exile during World War II, he essentially used to cut out newspaper clippings, images from newspapers, and he would just write a four-line poem in response to the image. And essentially, after the war ended, he went back to Germany, and he wasn't able to publish it because it was too anti-German at the time, but he wasn't even able to publish it outside of Germany because it was too pro. And so because sometimes the image and the text worked against one another or produced something that is in neither, could not be conceived of in polarity, and because it is very, very, it's an act of treason. It's an act of treason in many ways. And I don't know, personally, I'm very, like, I'm interested in that moment. I'm interested in this, you know, projects, for example, like Eyal, posit the fact that you are a traitor no matter what, right? That Sandy and Alessandro and Eyal are traitors in different places and are operating as... And so my question would be, where are you a traitor in Tijuana? How are you a traitor in America working in Tijuana? How, like, if that could be the way into a conversation about these practices, how could you, how could you define yourself as... I don't know.
It's interesting. I'm wondering how to get to this image, because it's exactly part of what I was trying to say. This is said more clearly in terms of the duplicitous nature of the state, which what is her name has written very much about that in the last years, Keller Easterling, arguing that it is in fact the ability to operate in that sort of double camouflage, that has allowed the right. In fact, she has brought up some of these texts in the context of the Tea Party, that have co-opted these strategies of the left and so on. But while the left maintains itself in this the kind of sanctity of its own kind of righteousness in terms of belief system and operations, it is the right and the corporate sort of power that has, in the state ultimately, that is therefore the critique of it, that has been operating based on that duplicity. And why is it that we cannot really enable that, So what I meant before about transcending the kind of polarization, not to seek necessarily consensus or anything, but it's just, can we find these concepts to be operative in rethinking the nature of practice, mm-hmm. as we might engage in fact this, how do you call it, this double...
Agent. Double agency. Agent. Yeah. I was just thinking of like your peace conversation to start. My name is Deborah and I'm a traitor. And then we can go. I'll tell you one thing. So I grew up in Israel, right? So a lot of Israelis who come here, you have the border, you have, right, migrants, all that kind of situation. We say, wow, it's like living in Israel, but you have psychological freedom. And that's a way of being a traitor, right? Is that I could? There's a lot of things here that just are just just hit me home. But I'm not going to the military. Definitely a way.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like it's really personally. The border for me here is just a place for peace. Because I come from a place where the border is not a place of peace. But then it's interesting to see oneself diverting towards a site that has a similar situation than the one that you come from, but that in that sense provides a shelter from the situation that you come from. Mm. Which usually has been kind of, again, in the vision of running away from something, is you go maybe to a different situation. But what if you ran away to actually the place where you did? But then that there is, in some way, either a psychological or a, another kind of a removal. But then, and we've experienced there's this sun, like you have these planes flying, which is a relationship that has nothing to do with the border, that has to do with a war that is being fought somewhere else. So it's the kind of this conglomeration of a visual system with a sonic system that belongs to, and each belong to a language that is completely different. So the planes maybe belong to the situation in Iraq or Afghanistan, the border belongs to the situation that is right here, but it also references another situation. So, and it's that kind of, I think it's, in my case, it's not being actually active in any of them. Being passive within, being just within in them, and actually being developing works that are about a third place or a fourth place, kind of. But the I don't know if
that figure of the traitor is the figure that I can't remember what the Greek term is for it, but it's supposed to be what is achieved through theory, according to Aristotle, is that you, I can't remember what the term is for, but it's a particular kind of stranger who is this traitor or that you speak about, that through that, you know, through theory, there is not this idea of this relationship of theory to practice, but just of theory as an activity through which you become this kind of stranger that you talk about. So I guess for me, when I was thinking of it, when I was, you know, reading that beginning part over and over again, because I also found it to be like the most interesting part of the essay, was the fact that, like, you know, there is this threshold being marked with this sign. It's not just a sign being randomly placed between these two spaces, but there's a threshold that's being between a space of collectivity, which is this inn,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
This life world, and
mm-hmm.
this outer space that is this space of the individual in a grave,
mm-hmm.
right? Kind of, the individual solidified in the grave.
Mm-hmm.
So really marked off from collectivity, but at the same time expressing some kind of absolute collectivity by being dead. So not really being even an individual anymore, to some extent, right? So I guess I was thinking about it as far as, you know, this piece, I guess, you know, marking this threshold between these two spaces, and that's what really interested me the most, I would say, about this. Like, I just wonder what would happen if you would have people focus on just that one image. Like, express that image literally, and I don't know, like, have that as an image, you know, there with the text, as opposed to just having this thing that, you know, one could treat this, because visually one treats this as all the rest of the text, right? Because it's visually, you know, because it's visually there just like that, just like everything else, right? But
you don't have to cut open the other pages.
But it's like the frame, you know, it's...
Yeah.
No, but it operates on the idea of borrowing, right? Like, it's actually not Kant, right? It's this really, this like kind of awesome innkeeper, right? They're like borrowing from a situation, right? And then
where
finding in
Dutch
that situation, you know, like
you?
Finding in within
yeah.
that situation something kind of really interesting. And like etymologically, I think traitor shares like roots with translation and trade. There's something about trade, translation, and traitor as this kind of like moment where it really comes together as this figure which really seamlessly finds themselves.
But
even if it
think...
is not accurate, I love
yeah.
it. No, I mean, it could be that.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
no,
I
might imagine it's accurate, but this is wonderful.
But
yeah.
if you think
it's
of the U.S. Constitution, too, it's like impossible to be a traitor now. For example, any executive, anyone who holds executive office, you really get the feeling like impeachment can't really ever happen. So it's, or like really being a traitor would only happen on a low level, right? Like, I forget the guy's name that went to Afghanistan. What was it, John? Do you remember the name of this guy?
That went to Afghanistan and...
And he became part, I think he trained with...
yeah.
What was his name?
Yeah.
And he's... Do you remember this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So he can become a traitor, but on any other high levels, I feel like, you know, if you're holding executive office, becoming a traitor would be pretty difficult. I don't know.
I want to go back to what you just said. I want to go back to it. Obviously, you helped us think about this role of the double agent or the traitor and the degree to which this is the role that all of us, in a certain sense, identify with, maybe, or that is the role of the artist. And I guess the question that I'm thinking about, the question that I have is, can you, I mean, you may internally identify as a traitor, but can you ever externally kind of project that identity to others? I mean, isn't the whole point that you have to somehow, in the name of being a traitor, you have to somehow conceal that status fundamentally from others? I mean, isn't that...
Not if you have a conspiracy of, right?
Conspirators.
Of traitors, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But what do you mean by, like, I don't know, you could externalize that by trying to renounce citizenship.
Uh-huh.
So then you would be declaring yourself a traitor everywhere,
uh-huh.
right? I'm talking in the terms of the nation state, then. Is that what you...
But wouldn't it be too easy, in a way, to renounce citizenship once and for all? Your project isn't over, but in a certain sense, it's a very different practice at that point.
I don't think externalizing the... being... I don't think you can't externalize being a traitor. That's the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're... That's what I think is an interesting thing about it, is that it's something that is about, it's an internal, it's only about this self kind of relationship to the self through, of course, you know, this, you know, oppositionality to the other all the time, right, in whatever context, but it's something that is individual. Its externalization is only internal, because otherwise you're not a traitor anymore once you declare it.
No, but it's also sometimes it's not something that you assume, it's something that is given to you, right? So it is already like you are called a traitor, right? You don't say I'm a traitor, right? The position, like, and you could be a double agent as a, you know, and that you also don't say, but like in terms of traitor, it's kind of more pointing at that, and what I was hinting at is the idea when we are all pointing at each other, which like then becomes this, like then establishes a new neutral zone of all, you know, like we're all okay, traitor, 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 and then so it is something that comes from the external, and then and then it may establish a situation where then the possibilities might be I don't know, there's a kind of like there. And essentially, sorry, being put in a situation where maybe either opposites, right, point at the same thing, right? So you can have the left, or let's, you know, on a very basic level, the left and the right point towards you and say you're a traitor, right? And so, because part of, that's what I was saying in terms of, like, this exercise, right? Or this exercise is, like, perpetual peace and the church. Like, a philosopher can point at you and tell you you're a traitor in part of your exercise, and maybe a statesman can also point at you and tell you that you're a traitor in another part of your exercise. But the fact that you've brought maybe two opposing systems and you've collapsed them on top of one another then announces something within that act of treason that you've made that then posits maybe some other option.